Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. I'm Cynthia Pooler. My guest today is Gus Christensen. And Gus is here to talk about the primary defeat of many of the former IDC members. So the name of your group is No IDC New York, correct?
It's No IDC NY, Cynthia, and thank you for having me on the show again.
It's my pleasure. This is going to be a fun conversation. So on election night, were you prepared for all of the victories that you guys worked so hard for?
I mean, it was hard to be prepared, I think, for that much, for that many victories. You know, we thought we were going to win a lot of these races. We thought that all of those races were very competitive, but you never can expect to win all of your competitive races. So we were incredibly happy, incredibly pleased with the results. You know, one of them still hasn't been called by the Board of Elections up in Syracuse. Rachel May and Dave Valesky's district. Rachel is up by, I believe, 606 votes after all of the Election Day votes were counted, but they still have a little over 600 absentee ballots to count. So if Dave Valesky were to have every single one of the absentee ballots, he might be able to come back, but we all know that's impossible. The absentee ballots will be split between the two of them, so we're highly confident that Rachel will win that race. It's just not certified by the Board of Elections yet.
Let me ask you this question. You know, in our previous conversations on Focus on Albany, you talked about the group opposing the IDC as something that happened after Donald Trump was elected. It was kind of a reaction to Donald Trump. Let me ask you this. Had Hillary Clinton won, do you think that the group that you formed and your friends formed would never have happened?
You know, it's hard to say, but I think it's quite possibly accurate. You know, we were able to really feed on the energy in the resistance movement. And, you know, the resistance movement started organically immediately after Donald Trump was elected to resist Donald Trump. And if Hillary Clinton had been elected, progressive activists wouldn't have had something to get angry about and something to resist. So, you know, I can't predict alternate futures and alternate realities. I think you're right that it certainly would have been a whole lot harder, if not impossible, to do this house cleaning if Hillary had been elected.
The leader, Jeff Klein, was defeated by Alessandra Biaggi. Now, Biaggi is the granddaughter of Mario Biaggi, who was a congressman back in the 70s. What was the winning margin for Ms. Biaggi?
You know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think she won by about 8 points, a pretty comfortable victory, and one that was easy to call on election night. You know, Alessandra Biaggi just ran an amazing campaign. She's a great candidate. If you meet Alessandra Biaggi, you will love Alessandra Biaggi. She is brilliant. She is charismatic. She has very infectious energy levels. And she is going to be an amazing, amazing state senator. And I think that every voter that had the opportunity to interact with her was able to see that. You know, she was able to beat the head of the IDC himself, Jeff Klein.
I found when I saw that on the news because I had gotten home late that evening. I got home a little after 11, and they showed the totals, and I was really shocked that Klein had lost. Now, in the race with Avella, you know, Avella was one of the late comers to the IDC. He was a pretty well noted senator for quite a number of years, and he had run against Lou once or twice before, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it was the wave that Lou won? And you know, what's your feeling about that? His beating Tony Avella.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, you know, Tony Avella is a longstanding elected official in his area of Queens. He was, I believe, a city council member for 8 or 10 years before becoming a state senator, and now he's been a state senator for 8 or 10 years. He is very well known in his district, and I think he's been personally liked by a lot of voters. John Liu was also a city council member in the bordering city council district that the state senate district overlaps both of them. John Liu was then elected to citywide office. He was the New York City controller he was the New York City controller from 2009 to 2013. And then in 2013, the year that Bill de Blasio was elected mayor, John Liu gave up being controller and also ran for mayor that year and lost. And so in 2014, following year, John Liu challenged Tony Avella, who was already a member of the IDC. I believe he's one of the original members. And John Liu ran a very, very close race against Tony Avella in 2014 and lost by fewer than 1,000 votes. And that was the year in which was the first and until this week the only time that IDC members have been challenged in primaries. Ollie Capel, also a former city council member and also a former New York State Attorney General, challenged Jeff Klein from his home in Riverdale in 2014. And those two challengers back in 2014, they started out with support, establishment support from labor unions, the Working Families Party, and other groups. But then in the summer of 2014, I believe in June, July, a couple months before the primary, Andrew Cuomo back then brokered a deal with the IDC that got Jeff Klein and the IDC to say back then that after the election in November of 2014, they were going to rejoin the mainline Democratic conference and stop caucusing with the Republicans. And when that supposed deal was announced in the summer of 2014, it really undermined the establishment support that John Liu and Ollie Capel had in their primaries. The Working Families Party backed away from them. All of their labor support melted away. And Ollie Capel, I think, went on to lose by maybe 58 to 42 while John Liu was closer, was within 1,000 votes, but still lost. And that was a very frustrating year for anybody who was against the IDC and in favor of real Democrats. But it was what it was. And you fast forward 4 years till now, and John Liu was able to flip that margin. I think that there were two things pulling against John Liu. You know, he got into this race very late. He only declared his candidacy at the very end of the petitioning period in June, July of this year. So he didn't have a long run up into the election. So that held him back a little bit. We had to get that campaign off the ground really, really quickly, number one. And number two, it's now been 5 years since John Liu was a citywide elected official, whereas in 2014 it had just been 1 year. And, you know, memories fade, name recognition fades. So he was coming at it from a slightly weaker position. But on the other hand, we had the tide with us this time, and we had the support of all the activist groups. Now, we still didn't have the support of the political establishment. The governor was working against us. The Queens Democratic Party was still working against us. But we had the activists. We had a much higher profile in the media for our case against the IDC. It became widely known among voters of New York over the past few months as to what the IDC was and why it was so terrible. And we think that that extra, you know, juice in John Liu's tank was enough to push him comfortably over the finish line to a victory.
Joe Crowley was defeated. So how do you think that Alexandria's race and her victory, was that instrumental in getting the 6 victories that you got against the former IDC members?
I think that it was very, very helpful, extraordinarily helpful in a number of different ways. Number one, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez herself became an extremely strong advocate for our challengers, endorsing Alessandra, endorsing Jessica, endorsing the others, and working very hard and campaigning very hard on their behalf. Alexandra has had an extremely high profile in the media, obviously, ever since she won that primary, and she was extraordinarily generous and supportive in using her profile to support our case and support our candidates. So that was very helpful, number one. Number two, she demonstrated the viability of a progressive challenger path to victory in legislative district primaries over entrenched incumbents with a lot more money. And, you know, if you look at the race that Jessica Ramos or especially Alessandra Biaggi ran, where they're massively outspent by the incumbent. And really, when you look at Alessandra Biaggi versus Jeff Klein, you've got a lot of parallels, right? You know, you have an older white man representing a district that has become a lot more diverse since he was first elected. He's somebody who has a tremendous, tremendous monetary advantage, someone who is running TV commercials and a heavy, heavy, expensive airwaves campaign against you, and you have a much younger woman challenging him who is doing it through organizing, who is doing it through being an inspirational leader to volunteers and activists and residents of the district, working 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, getting out in front of those voters, knocking on doors, going to churches, to synagogues, to shopping malls, and seeing the voters in person, inspiring their volunteers to work the phones and knock more doors, and counteract the expensive television messaging campaign and mailer messaging campaign that the incumbent with all the money is running, and counteracting that with real human contact. You know, Alessandra proved that that was a viable path, you know, across the country, but very specifically in the Bronx and Queens. And, you know, our candidates followed a pretty similar path, and they won.
One of the reasons I believe that Tony Avella joined the IDC because it was known that the IDC could raise more money than the mainline Dems. So is the fact that, you know, the IDC was able to raise a lot of money. First of all, where did that money come from?
So the IDC raises a ton of money, and it mostly comes from transactional donors. It comes most specifically from the real estate industry and from charter school backing interests. These are interest groups that have a tremendous amount of money and that also have a very strong interest in trying to preserve Republican control of the New York State Senate and Republican influence in New York State politics. The real estate industry, rightly or wrongly, and presumably rightly, perceived for decades now that the Republicans in the state Senate were going to be the ones who protected their interests on rent laws, tax laws, development laws, and they needed Republicans to carry water for them and to have power in Albany. Well, right there is where, you know, anyone can see, and ultimately voters were able to see, that the IDC was really representative of Republican interests, not Democratic interests. The donors who were putting enormous amounts of money behind them, you're talking about millions of dollars, right? The donors who were doing that because they wanted Republican control of the New York State Senate. And, you know, knock on wood, but my belief now is that, you know, that tide of Republican money will recede in the New York State Senate because, you know, hopefully we're not quite there yet. We got to win some red to blue seats in November, but I think we are inches away from having a sustainable long-term Democratic majority in the New York State Senate. And once we take away even the possibility of Republican control of the state Senate, then I think a lot of those big money interests that have been behind the IDC and behind the Republicans in the state Senate in general, they may well dial back their giving if they're not actually getting anything in exchange for it. Because in the end, they're transactional donors. They're not giving out of love. They're not giving out of ideological alignment. They're giving because they're getting something in return. And when they're not getting anything in return anymore, hopefully they'll go home.
I want to raise one more fact about Avella.
Sure.
Tony Avella, when he was with the mainstream Dems, was a big proponent of anti-fracking. I see him at rallies. He was so against fracking. And then he joined the IDC. Was it only money? I mean, didn't he have an ideological, you know, framework in which he operated day by day, or was it only the money that propelled him to join the IDC?
You know, I think that the people who joined the IDC in general were taking the easy way out. They were morally and ethically bankrupt people who may well, when they got into politics in the first place, have gotten into it on idealistic grounds, really believing that they were fighting for certain things, whether it was fighting against fracking or fighting for tenants' rights or workers' rights or whatever it was that inspired them to become Democratic elected officials in the first place, because, you know, they were Democrats once upon a time. I think that they were deeply cynical by the time they joined the IDC. They were no longer really, truly in their hearts fighting for those things, because if they really were, they would have fought for Democratic control of the state Senate, not Republican control.
Right.
And, you know, there comes a time when you got to change elected officials. You know, getting elected to a 2-year term in the New York State Assembly, the New York State Senate, the U.S. House of Representatives, whatever it may be, you got elected to a 2-year term, not to a lifetime appointment. This isn't a federal judgeship. You know, people change, and their ability to remain idealistic and to get work done changes. And when it changes for the negative, deeply negative, like it did with these IDC members, it's time to get new representatives, you know? And that's what we've got here. We've got a crop of amazing, amazing new state senators going to Albany. You know, we ran a slate against the IDC that was entirely composed of women and people of color. We ran a slate that was, on average, a decade or two younger than the people that they were replacing. We're sending in new blood, new ideas, you know, new people who are much more representative of today's Democratic Party and today's Democratic coalition, people who are not cynical about politics and about the Democratic Party platform, people who really are going to fight tooth and nail for universal health care, for tenants' rights, for immigrant protection, for more affordable housing in New York, for criminal justice reform, things that individual members of the IDC may have said all along that they supported, but that they didn't really fight for.
Let me ask you this question. You know, as much as we love politics, you and I do not have a crystal ball that could see the future. Let's say the numbers remain the same. All the incumbents that are running for the general win. That means that the balance of power is Felder in Brooklyn. If the balance of power was in Felder's hands and Flanagan did his best to make sure that Felder stayed in the Republican fold, do you think that's a possibility?
I certainly think it's a possibility that Felder remains in the Republican fold. We're going to do everything in our power to make sure that he's not welcome back as a Democrat because he's not a Democrat. But I do not believe that it's possible that the Democrats will not win enough red to blue seats in November to take over. I mean, first of all, you know, you made a good point in there that incumbents, you know, for better or worse, are likely to be reelected. But that said, I think you've had a half a dozen Republican state senators choose to retire this year rather than face reelection. So people like, what's his name, John Bunkacek in the Hudson Valley, and several more on Long Island, the Hudson Valley, and upstate, and in western New York. I think it's at least six of the Republican incumbents have chosen to retire rather than run for reelection. So the Republicans aren't just defending incumbents. They're defending a whole bunch of open seats. And, you know, the odds that the Democrats will be able to take at least one or two, if not four or five, of those open seats, those are really, really good odds. Those odds are a whole lot better than the odds that we had in the primaries of taking six of these seats. So I'm very, very confident that the Democrats will take the open seats that they need to take this fall. You know, we'll see whether Andrew Cuomo lifts a finger to do it or not. He said that he would, but, you know, he said he would do a lot of things in the past that he didn't do. And he also has this fall a lot of red to blue competitive districts in the U.S. House of Representatives. There's five or six of those seats that are competitive in New York State. And, you know, I could easily see him devoting all of his energy to that rather than the state Senate. But with or without him, I think we've got plenty of energy, activist, progressive voter energy, and there'll be plenty of small-dollar campaign contributions flowing in from the activists to the Democratic state Senate candidates in swing districts. And so I think that that we're easily going to win at least, you know, we only need one for Simca Felder's vote to be meaningless on the Republican side. But I'll tell you, I want to win at a bare minimum three so that Diane Savino and David Carlucci's votes are no longer needed anymore, because I don't believe that they should be welcome in the Democratic Party. And hopefully we'll take four or five so that we can completely ostracize Felder, Carlucci, and Savino and still have a comfortable working majority.
Let's talk a little bit about the leadership with the mainstream Dems. You know, Andrea Stewart Cousins, she's a great person. I like her a lot. She's very personable. She's very friendly. But do you think she has the stuff to really, you know, knuckle down and lead the party in a way that will move it forward?
I certainly think so. I think she's a brilliant woman. I think she's a great tactician and a great leader. I think that by getting rid of Jeff Klein, who was, you know, in a semi-negotiated position as of their last deal in April, the governor pushed through where he was going to be becoming the deputy leader instead of Mike Gianaris. All that crap is done with. Mike Gianaris is a very capable deputy. He will be, with Jeff Klein out of the way, he will be able to work closely with Andrea Stewart-Cousins and the rest of the leadership, you know, and we don't need anyone from the IDC in the leadership, you know. Fingers crossed, like I was saying before, we're not even going to need their votes, and we're going to have, you know, a much more unified mainline Democratic conference. And it's not unified by allying the IDC with the mainline. It's unified by getting rid of the IDC and having only true blue mainline Democrats in the mainline conference.
I remember hearing when Carlucci was first elected that there was a lot of effort into his victory. And then he turns around, and then he joins the IDC, and a lot of people were angry with that. Okay, mm-hmm. From your perspective, what's going to happen to Carlucci? And more importantly, she was aligned with Klein, Savino.
With Diane Savino, yeah. No, I think that's a great question. I think the answer is this. They need to lose their seats. They need to lose their jobs. They do not get to remain in the state Senate forever. They will be challenged again. What they've done is unforgivable. They may have managed to survive this first election cycle, but they will not survive their primaries in 2020. I will look in my crystal ball and make a prediction. My prediction is that Diane Savino is no longer in the state Senate a year from now. My prediction is that Andrew Cuomo will give her a cushy appointment to some job like New York State Labor Commissioner that pays more than being a state senator, and that means she won't be in front of voters again, and that means she won't be a state senator anymore. David Carlucci, I think, may try to hold on. He's had more support from his county party than a lot of the candidates who lost. But, Julie Goldberg came quite close to him, far closer, I think, than he imagined going into that primary. And when all of the activist energy 2 years from now is focused behind just two candidates, the challengers to Carlucci and Savino, I'm sorry, make that three challengers, because it'll all be focused behind Felder's challenger as well. We're going to go from fighting nine races and winning six out of nine to fighting three races, and we're going to win three out of three. So none of the three of them will continue to be state senators after 2020, if they even make it that long.
In the Felder race, I became pretty friendly with Blake Mars.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was hoping that he would win, but he didn't. And they said that there was a big push by rabbis in Brooklyn that propelled him to the victory. Now, I think, and Blake disagrees with me, I think Felder, if he wants, has a seat for life. What do you think?
Well, here's the thing. Felder has a transactional seat. Felder has support from his religious ethnic community, but he also has support from donors and from a lot of people within his own community that's based on his transactional ability to get results for his community. And we're going to work very hard to make sure that he has none of that power going forward, okay? We do not believe that the Democrats should accept him and seat him with their caucus with the Democratic Party at all come January of 2019, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So when he is – because remember, Simcha Felder actually runs as both the Democrat and the Republican. He's on the Republican line in November in addition to the Democratic line. He makes no bones about, you know, the IDC would pretend to be Democrats while voting for Republican leadership. But Simcha Felder doesn't even pretend that. He says, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm whatever I need to be to deliver for my community. Well, the answer is we need to make it impossible for him to deliver for his community. He needs to receive no staff, no office, no committee assignments, no nothing from the Democratic Party, okay? He needs to be made miserable in the powerless Republican minority of the years to come. And then, you know, when he has no power, he will either go away himself or suffer from reduced support because it's transactional support that goes with power. When he has no power, he has no support. And then whether it's Blake Morris with somebody else, he'll lose the primary and election too.
Now, since you won 6 out of 8, which is totally amazing, one other question before we get into your group. I had read that there was an effort by the Queens Democratic Committee to stack the deck in favor of people who were closely aligned with their way of thinking, and a lot of the people that were recruited to become committee members didn't even know about it. In other words, they're afraid of the insurgents. What's your thought?
It's not just Queens. You know, Queens got caught for it, but Brooklyn does much the same thing, where the machine that controls the county party committee wants to ensure its control going forward, and it does that by having a bunch of patsies in the county committee seats rather than having committed activists. And so they do things like put names down on the county committee from people who've moved to Florida or died or don't even know that they're being put on the committee. Because the machine would rather have that than somebody who might actually, you know, be an activist with some free thinking ability to vote for somebody other than a machine candidate. So the machines in Brooklyn and Queens and the Bronx, they do that. And they also, as activists, try to petition to get on the committee. You know, they challenge their ballot, they challenge their petitions. There were dozens of young activists in Brooklyn, young and old, who petitioned to get onto the county committee this year, and the county party got, you know, high-priced lawyers to challenge their petitions and knock them off the ballot. So these county parties aren't going to give up without a fight, they have, you know, they've got 9 lives. They've been hanging on to power inside the city for decades since the fall of Tammany Hall in Manhattan. And, you know, knock on wood, they won't last much longer, but, you know, judicial politics, the ability to select judges, is a real power and a real patronage mill for them that, you know, is power that they want to keep and which also generates a lot of money for them to keep that power. So there are real, you know, judicial reform in New York State is, you know, one of many really important areas that we're hoping that a newly empowered activist bloc in the state Senate will be able to push forward because, you know, the way the system is now, it's bad. It's undemocratic. It's corrupt. You know, we should be able to do better in New York.
A lot of people, or I would say a majority of people, in not only New York State, but across the country, have no idea, you know, of the role of the party in elective politics. You know, I mean, you talked about Queens and other boroughs, and I'm sure it happens in other places. How do you enlighten the people to make them understand that part of the problem is the party itself?
Well, I think that a lot of that progress has been made at the higher levels on the ticket. So when when you have the presidential primary battles between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in 2016, you saw a debate that had long been, private and not widely known, get blown open in public in front of the mass media and in front of the newly energized activist base, many of whom were supporting Bernie Sanders. And that was a debate as to whether the DNC, the national party, should have its fingers on the scales or not. And this is a debate that hadn't really been, I think, aired nationally with that much attention probably since the 1968 convention in Chicago with the riots and everything, which was before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen it from a historical perspective. You know, that was a time when the Democratic Party switched from having candidates chosen in the stereotypical smoke-filled rooms and replaced them with an open primary system. And, in the decades since then, pendulum has swung back and forth as to how much power party insiders should have versus just straight-up primary voters. And that led to the creation of the superdelegates on the Democratic side who would be able to, who were incumbent elected officials themselves and who would get votes outside of the primary system. The argument was that that's the way that we would get the most electable Democrats on the ticket. And, you look at the Republican side and you got to wonder for a second if the Republicans had the equivalent of superdelegates to stop the rise of Trump, that maybe they would have come out with a more sane presidential candidate themselves. And that drills down then to the state level debate where Andrew Cuomo controls the New York State Democratic Party, and he used the New York State Democratic Party to fight primary battles for him. He pumped money through it to produce TV commercials and mailers on behalf of his quote slate of himself and Kathy Hochul and Tish James for Attorney General. And, activists don't like that and have seen it and taken note of it. And I do think that we could see more energy, activist energy, devoted in the coming electoral cycles to pushing back on that insider control of the national, the state, and the county parties, and trying to move it back more to the people. We'll see. I support that fight. I'll do what I can to help in that fight. But you're fighting a machine that has, been in power for a very long time, and will do everything it can to stay in power.
You mentioned the word activist. People like yourself and me, who's aware of what is going on, but the average person who's, working and barely has time to look and see what's going on in the rest of the world, they have no idea the role of the party. You're talking activists, but for the guy who might vote, might not vote, they don't know what the party means.
I get it. You're spot on, Cynthia. Look, people have lives. People got to go to work. They got to take their kids to school. They got to care for aging parents. Everybody has a busy, messy, complicated life. And it is absolutely only a small fraction of people who can devote enough time and energy to political activity that they can really, you know, drill through and really start to understand this level of information about what's going on in party politics. You know, I think you know, at its root, this is the downside of federalism. You know, this is the downside of our system of government in the United States. You know, if you live in another Western democracy, and you know, in a parliamentary democracy in Europe, you may have as few as two or three elected officials that you can vote for yourself. You may have a member of parliament. If you live in Europe, you may have a member of European Parliament, and that might be it. You might have a city council member or a mayor or something in local government, but that's it. They don't have states. They don't have direct election of presidents. They have prime ministers who are chosen by the members of parliament. So you may elect as few as two people. In contrast, if you're a resident of New York State, you are responsible, whether you know it or not, for voting for 15, 16, 17 different people, excluding judges. Mm-hmm. And depending on what county you live in, if you live in New York County like I do in Manhattan, there's several hundred judges that you're responsible for electing as well. So you're responsible mm-hmm. for electing four statewide elected officials, a governor, a lieutenant governor, a controller, and a state attorney general. You're responsible for electing five federal officials, a president, a vice president, two U.S. senators, and a member of Congress. That's nine right there. Then you're responsible for electing a state senator and a state assembly member. That's 11. Then if you live in New York City, you've got a city council member, a borough president, and three citywide officials, a controller, a public advocate, and a mayor. That's five more at the city level. That gets you up to mm-hmm. 16, 17 elected officials that you're responsible for voting for, theoretically in primaries and in general elections, excluding judges. If you walk out mm-hmm. of the street and you ask people to come up with that list of 16 or 17 offices and you ask them to name who's in those offices and when and how they were elected, you're going to get 0.1% of people who can answer that question, right? It's a complicated system, and it's what our Constitution has given us, and so we got to kind of work through it. And that's probably a topic for a whole other interview, Cynthia.
Okay. Now, one last question. What's on the horizon for your group?
So we've got to do two things, you know. We've got to help ensure that – well, three things. First of all, we got to make sure that our candidates who won their primaries last week win their general elections, so that people like Jeff Klein, you know, don't continue to run on the Independence Party line or the Reform Party line or the so-called Women's Equality Party line, because they've got some other ballot lines.
Mm-hmm.
We got to make sure that they're not running and that if they do, that they lose. Number one. Number two, we got to make sure that we win enough red to blue seats to have a comfortable Democratic majority in the state Senate come January. And number three, we got to work on getting challengers lined up now, whether it's our same challengers who are going to run again in 2 years the way Robert Jackson did, or whether it's new challengers. We got to make sure that Diane Savino, David Carlucci, and Simca Felder are facing even stronger challenges in 2020 so that they lose their seats and we put this era of fake Democrats to rest once and for all.
It sounds like a pretty tall order, Gus. What do you think?
I don't know. That's what everybody said when we said we were going to run candidates against all of them in the first place. And look, six of them won. So I'm in a good mood. I'm optimistic about it. I think we're going to create a truly progressive, energetic, Democratic-controlled New York State Senate. And I think that we're about to enter a real kind of golden era of reform progressive politics in New York State. You know, I'm an optimist, Cynthia. What can I say?
This is a conversation that will be continued. So you've been listening to Gus Christensen, and give a little plug for your group again.
Sure, Cynthia, thank you. My group, I'm the chief strategist of NOIDCNY. You can find us online at www.noidcny.org. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. We hope to hear from you all and find an even bigger group of allies and activists for the fights ahead.
Thank you. So if you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes. If you have a comment about this show, hashtag Focus on Albany on Twitter. Gus, I look forward to many more conversations as this whole thing evolves and unfolds. So thanks so much. Have a great Sunday. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a good day.
Thank you, Cynthia.